It's Sunday, May 31st, 2015, and welcome to episode 177 of Tech Talk for Teachers. I'm Tom Grissom. Welcome to Tech Talk for Teachers, the show about teaching and learning with technology. And this time, Cindy Rich could not make it with us today to do this recording. However, we did record a segment earlier this month. But up first today, what I wanted to do was just kind of do a debriefing. I am just fresh off the attending Faculty Summer Institute at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of this past week, had the opportunity to attend and also presented a session. And I just want to reflect on just some of the things as I was driving back and forth. UIUC is only about an hour from Eastern Illinois University, so it gave me an opportunity each day as I was driving back and forth to just kind of debrief and think about some of the things. And after thinking about reflecting back on the conference the last 3 days, one of the things that really struck me was how process-oriented I seemed to be. I did do a session. The name of the session was Teaching and Learning with the Cloud, with an emphasis on using OneNote, the note-taking app, and presented that content. For those of you not familiar, if you listen to Tech Talk for Teachers, you know I'm a huge OneNote fan. But one of the reasons I like OneNote is it's essentially a blank canvas, and you can make it what you want it to be. Now, for some, that may be intimidating because it's one of those applications that's difficult to start with, because there's not that structure like some of the other apps. However, the strength of that is you can do about anything that you want. Works for any subject area, and it's also available cross-platform, so it offers some major advantages there. But it struck me reflecting back and crystallized in my mind, being a teacher education college here at EIU, how much we are involved with the process of teaching and learning, and focus on that process a lot versus the end product. And that's why I think I like OneNote so much. But it really did crystallize in my mind the ability to go out and work with our students. And I did some demonstrations of just using OneNote and just kind of on the fly what we could do with OneNote with students and have the notes immediately available. But OneNote's just equivalent to a 3-ring binder, and you can store it in the cloud, so that means that you can share it with others. But the advantage as a teacher, I can on the fly make adjustments to my teaching. And I think that's sometimes something that we miss at conferences because we kind of come with the formal PowerPoint structure, point, 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 in kind of a linear fashion. But I think that's one of the strengths. I also stated in my presentation that learning's messy, and so is teaching. And sometimes, again, I think that particularly at a professional conference, we don't sometimes see that process. And every one of the presenters did, a very good job producing the content and things, but rarely do we get to see all of the effort involved with some of those final presentations. We'll look at a PowerPoint and not realize that somebody's has tens, if not hundreds, of hours just in that one presentation, sharing all the research and findings with it. So just wanted to mention that and just kind of give you my thoughts. It was a great conference. Of course, I went last year, so I was able to catch up with some old friends and good opportunity to get away and just kind of compare notes with some of our fellow higher ed faculty. So with that, we'll just go ahead. I've got a recording here that Cindy and I did earlier this month, so we'll just start there, and here we go. Today, I thought we would talk about some of the summer plans and offerings that are going on here at EIU and across campus. And I always like to kind of take on a couple of personal projects, personal growth projects, and investigate something that I might not necessarily know too much about. And Cindy, I know you're going to be completely busy with all your professional development and things with the Teaching with Primary Sources grant. So
it's always interesting because, working at a university, people say, do you get your summer off?
Yeah.
And it's like, nope, that's our busiest time. Yeah. That's whenever I'm, hitting it hard, because – That's when teachers have time
right.
to do professional development. And so things are really getting ready to start kicking off and jumping right in. And so we've got a couple of different professional development. We're focusing primarily on literacy mm-hmm. and primary sources this summer. So that's fun because that's one of my passions anyway, or you know, where I started in mm-hmm. education. And so that's been a really interesting project. And with that, the Library of Congress has a teachers network that's an internal network right now for people that work with TPS programs, but it's growing in that. And so we've started some groups within that mm-hmm. and have a literacy group and a literature group mm-hmm. And different things that we're posting.
Yeah, primarily online or face-to-face
yeah,
or
online.
Both? Or
all on okay. 100% online. And so we're testing that out. It's one, you know, there are things that works well for sharing.
Right.
But there's no really immediate feedback because we're all in different time zones, right. different places and right. things like that. Also, I'm so used to a Facebook type platform where I get these little notifications and mm-hmm. all that, and that's not in place in that network. Mm-hmm. So it's funny how we expect, we right. get so used to these certain platforms no. and things that we use all of the time that we expect everything to be right. up to that standard.
Right.
And so there's a little bit of a learning curve going on with that.
Right.
But this summer, hopefully, we'll get a little more time into that and get it developed. But it should be interesting, and it's always fun to collaborate with teachers. You know, anybody that you've never met face-to-face and probably never would have met.
Right.
Except for this online opportunity. And so that's really fun.
Yeah, and we've talked in the past, you know, about, you know, the pluses and minuses of the online versus a face-to-face, and probably the answers, you know, both, a blended approach in doing that. But, you know, that's been my experience with Twitter. There's, you know, many, many people that I feel like I know fairly well just from an online mm-hmm. experience, and someday I hope to meet many of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, those are opportunities that I never would have had it not been for,
right.
you know, Twitter and developing that professional learning network out there. Well, and I kind of have those go-to people, those experts, you know, if I get into a bind. Or, it's just really nice to have that resource available.
It is. It is. Well, and we've got a couple of conferences. The International Literacy Association Conference, the annual conventions in St. Louis mm-hmm. in July. And that's a big one. It's an exciting conference. And but then the National Council for Social Studies is coming up in November, and I'm doing a poster presentation mm-hmm. for that, which is kind of funny because we talk about the tech, but then we still do these poster presentations
right.
with a 4x8.
Right.
But we take our laptops and iPads and have those going at the same time. It's cool because I co-present with teachers or with other educators from different parts of the country, mm-hmm. and we can do it mm-hmm. online like that and put it all together and not actually talk on the phone even. We just
right.
do it all electronically. And one of the things I've noticed this summer, I have a ton of like WebEx type meetings,
mm-hmm. webinars,
and conference calls, and everything's being done in that way. And
right.
again, our committees are made up of people from all over the country, which is neat. You know, we use Doodle or whatever to schedule them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great service.
It is. And then something like WebEx or whatever to have these online, and someone shares their desktop and.
Mm-hmm.
And we either call in or we, you know, you can go in through your computer. I tend to call in because then I can mute it, listen, and then unmute when I need to say something.
Yeah.
And that. But, you know, it definitely is changing the way we're working
yeah.
this summer. And then I was talking to a friend in one of the departments here on campus, and they said that, you know, they're only offering two bottoms in the seats, you know, classes. Mm-hmm. The rest are all online
yeah.
this summer. So I think in the summer we see an increase of that
yeah, we do.
As well. And that.
And it gives the opportunity for the on-campus students and things, you know, to go back home over the summer.
Right.
A lot of them have summertime jobs as well, and just a little bit more flexible environment for them to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that's definitely increasing. We should probably also mention, I'm recording this on May 20th, a little bit earlier than what we
yeah.
typically do, because you're going to be traveling next week.
Yeah.
And I've got a conference. Next week is our Faculty Summer Institute. I'll be doing a presentation on teaching and learning in the cloud.
Very cool.
So share some of the things that we've been doing here at the ITC and, you know, some of the resources available there. But, you know, it's conference time, professional development time. The teachers are out there. So as you say, summer, it's, you know, it is a very, very busy time. And in the ed tech world, of course, we're doing all kinds of software updates and hardware updates mm-hmm. and switching things out. So, it's a little bit more laid back. It is just being the nature of summer and things, but there's definitely a lot of work to be done.
Well, and I'm leaving for vacation, family vacation.
Yeah, all right.
And that. So, and trying to figure out if I can force myself to unplug.
Yeah.
And that's tough because even when you put the auto reply on your email and all of that, you still see them coming through.
Talk about notifications. It's like.
Yeah, exactly. And so, there's plus and minuses to it. Yeah. And it's like, but I've got to,
unplug.
When we hit the beach, the phone has to stay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to be in June. My wife actually has a conference on Google Apps for Education. So I'm going to be going up there with her in Chicago.
Oh, very cool.
So I'm planning on, taking a little bit more laid back approach and let her do the work for that week and things, but have a chance to get away.
Wonderful.
So here's another conversation I've been having recently with faculty and I'd like to get your opinion on, or your thoughts about this. I've been having a conversation with some faculty as we work through some student assignments and, just kind of instructional design talk. Do you think it's necessary for a student to understand what I call the analog process, the real world process before moving to digital? I give you some examples on where this is going. And my view, and where some of this goes with different types of faculty, it's like some people wish, let's just throw away the technology. It's like, it's kind of a distraction, possibly. Or is it a benefit? And I guess another reason this popped up on my radar screen here recently is there was a study that just came out. I don't know if you saw it about cell phones, how cell phones have a negative impact on academic performance.
Oh.
So in my community, in the ed tech community, that's quite a debate going on out there. It's like, do we ban the technology, such as cell phones, which is essentially is a mobile computer, for all practical purposes today. Does it cut into the concentration time? And this study said yes. They're a distraction and it has a negative academic performance result. Of course, the debate going around the community, it's like, here's control group and everything. But did you actually look at how they could improve? Because like anything in research, there's 100 other questions that are raised.
Oh, heck yeah. That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, I'm a doodler. And so if I didn't have a phone, I'd draw all over my papers, all over agendas, everything constantly. I'm listening.
Right.
And I'm engaged. But
that's interesting because
I
am too, but in a view of some instructors, that might be
detrimental
behavior because you're over there scribbling or whatever, but you're actually using, and I do it too, as a thinking tool, drawing things, symbols and things that you can't do, which again is why I'm such a OneNote proponent with the digital ink, things that you can't do on a keyboard.
Right.
It's really, I don't know if it's a generational thing. There's a lot of research to be done in this area, but there is some research out there that's talking about the pen-based computing and things and how beneficial it is for those types of learners to go out there. And as a math teacher, as a science teacher, solving word problems, I don't know how many times I have said to students, well, here's your problem, draw a picture.
Oh, and even with language arts, if they're reading something, being able to annotate and highlight and circle and draw arrows to related ideas and things like that and cause and effect and stuff, so there's so many applications to be able to physically interact with what you're using.
But like with our students, in keeping something as simple as notes and things, of course, many people have the three-ring binders and things in the analog, paper-based format. But there is, if you get to the point of utilizing the technology, we've talked about the SAMR model of substitution, augmentation, modification, and redefinition before. If you're purely using it as a substitute, you know, I can say, what's the point?
Right.
But even if you are, say, making a digital or a analog notebook, paper-based notebook, mm-hmm. and also at the same time keeping it digitally, even if it's nothing more than a duplication, mm-hmm. I still think there's value in that because it's a repetition of that right. learning cycle,
yeah.
transcribing the notes or whatever, or reprocessing. And some people may look at that as busy work, you know.
I still have a paper calendar. I still mm-hmm. have a planner that I write in mm-hmm. because the more times I write down something, mm-hmm. the more I know I'm going to mm-hmm. remember it. And so, you know, it's the same theory.
Mm-hmm.
That also, I think this is a generation of multitaskers.
Mm-hmm.
The kids we have now very seldom do one thing at a time.
Mm-hmm.
They're listening to music. They're talking on their phone. I mean, they're just multitasking all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when we ask them to just sit and listen, it's really hard,
mm-hmm.
very hard for them to do. And so, you know, I think you and I kind of talked about this with one of the things when I started working with this primary source, teaching with primary sources, is making it part of the culture. So it's not just this, ta-da, special thing. Look what we're going to do.
Right.
We're going to use this
today.
It's not
an add-on.
Right. And then, you know, the focus shifts to that. So the days of, oh, today's computer day, we get to, you know, and
right.
then do a lesson, that it's just part of the culture of the classroom.
Right.
And they're using the technology and they're using the phones and it's not a big deal. You get it out, you put it away. But if it's once a month or this big thing where, okay, today you get to pull out your phones, heck yeah, most of them are going to check their text messages mm-hmm. and things like mm-hmm. that while they've got it out.
Right. Right. But the value in going to the digital, taking it to the next step and things with the collaborative note taking,
mm-hmm.
just, again, a lot of the work and some things that I'll share next week at this Faculty Summer Institute, just the ability of a student, if nothing more than to have the instructor notes immediately whenever they walk out of the classroom. Again, in higher education, especially whenever you're teaching a complex subject like, you know, math, calculus,
mm-hmm.
Some science, you know, some really involved, as you say, deeper type thinking that requires processing, especially as a new learner, the first time you're being exposed
right.
to some of this. And, you know, all teachers are guilty of this. We've done it so many times. It's just natural to us. But we need to back up and remember that this is the first time a student's seen mm-hmm. a lot of this material. And it took us, you know, multiple times
right.
to understand it to begin with. And I think, you know, using like OneNote is essentially a whiteboard, that digital whiteboard, immediately sharing a link out there that the students have that. And then they talk about this transposing and things. The student can take the instructor notes, pick out different nuggets and things that they mm-hmm. may need to learn more about, and put it into their own either shared or private notebook area for them to elaborate on. It's like, oh, here's my problem area that I'm still not understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, taking it again to that next level of collaboration where you have multiple learners working in groups, it's very easy to do. You know, you say we're doing more webinars and type things. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's not special anymore. I mean, it's just part of a work
right.
day.
But as far as, like, you know, the OneNote, and we've talked about Google Docs and a lot of the different things, it's just that crossing of platforms and what we're all used to using.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a school where they're using OneNote, they're using things like that from day one, and it's just part of the culture of the school, it's easy. But then when you drop them in a university and they've never used it and they're being, you know, you have mm-hmm. that whole learning curve there mm-hmm. too. And so that's my only issue with some of the platforms we talk about
mm-hmm.
because we all use different things. And I appreciate OneNote. I have access to OneNote. I still don't use OneNote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I played with it a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but boy, not much.
Are you using the Google for a substitute for OneNote?
Nope.
Or are you just pretty much all paper-based and keeping it that
paper
way?
Paper and just docs,
mm-hmm.
different docs.
I don't have any trouble, you know, going across the platforms and things short of losing the benefit, and this becomes important whether you're a Google Apps for Education or an Office 365 school. We're Office 365 here at EIU,
mm-hmm.
so that's where I'm putting my efforts. But I very easily go over to Google Apps for Education. There'll be a lot of things that I miss because I know the Office 365
right.
tool so well. But as far, I mean, collaborative note-taking, you can do it with a Google Doc.
Right.
You just lose all kinds of things with pen-based
yeah.
computing, OneNote. And, you
and
know.
I just got a new iPad, and it's got a couple of apps that are on it. It's got Keynote, Pages, and Numbers.
That's all the Apple products.
Right. And so, you know, there are all these different ones out there. And
we're back to the Tower of Babel that we've been before, you know, all these silos of information. It's like everybody wants to play within their own silo. You know, again, that's one good thing with OneNote. It does work on your, you know, you can have Office 365 apps on your iPad, on your Chromebook, on a PC, on a Mac. They are cross-platform, so that's a plus in that area. But for the sharing for teachers and things, like if you're a Google Apps for Education school, I mean, that's great because you have the common directory and the capability to share. And this is something that we struggle with because there are, you know, if you could kind of pick best of breed from each one of the different applications, like what's the best word processor, what's the best. But we're not in a situation for, I would say, the average user, you know, they just want to get their work done. They want one way to learn how to do that. And some people have a little bit more trouble going from one to the other.
Well, and you want what the other people that you work with are using.
Right.
Because it doesn't matter how cool, you know, it's just like sometimes you do a PowerPoint back in the day, you would have it all put together. You'd go, you'd load it, and that computer didn't have the same font and things like that. And then it was all screwy looking.
Right.
Because
which is one of the benefits, and we've kind of, as a ed tech community, kind of dropped the ball on this. That was the whole argument behind web apps. It's like, oh, we'll just have this web out there, the World Wide Web. We have a browser, and now we have browsers. Does it work in Chrome? Yeah. Does it work in IE? Does it work in Firefox? Is it Opera? And they're all tweak it just a little bit. And, you know, I'm a huge advocate of the HTML5 standard, and it's like, can't we all get along and just program to one, you know, one common thing that will work across browsers? We're just going through one of those growing pains right now because the innovation, you know, it's not all been worked out. I guess it has in the past with previous versions of HTML, but it seems to be getting a little bit worse with some of the cross-browser incompatibilities.
Right.
But hopefully, you know, we'll all get along and use a little bit more of the standards. But as a teacher, as a student, as a parent, you know, being able to access those school resources, having a common universal format such as the web, HTML5, makes a huge difference. You know, not so long ago, I mean, Flash, you know, that was considered the de facto standard, but it was proprietary.
Yeah.
You know, Shockwave plugins, Flash plugins, Silverlight plugins, QuickTime, you know, all these plugins. And we're kind of back in that world with Google extensions and things. You know, I think it will sort itself out. It's just going to – we're not there yet. It's going to take a, you know, a few more years. So I don't know how we got off on that. I guess we started talking about analog and to digital and things. But these are the issues when you get into the real world and try making this work in the classroom.
Right.
And all the talk with bring your own device and things. It's like, is this an Android phone? Is it an iPhone? You know, is it a Windows phone? Just those cross compatibilities, and knowing as much as I know about technology, that would be a very challenging environment for me to teach in if everybody had a different brand, different version, different operating system. So I always keep that in mind whenever you design to try finding that common denominator out there. And there you know, there are the standards out there, but you know, you mentioned the iPad and something that I'm seeing like iBooks. It's like, well, that's a great program, iBooks Author, and, you know, make your own thing. But it only works on iPad.
Right.
So it's one of those silos again. How much time do you want to invest? Or, you know, and then you end up with something like Kindle. Again, another proprietary format, but it's kind of the de facto standard out there for.
Yeah, it's
proprietary.
By making it, you know, exclusive, you're also eliminating audience.
Right.
And so what do you want to be? Do you want to be exclusive or do you want to be accessible?
Right. Yeah. Kind of a philosophical discussion there, but something that I think as educators, we certainly need to be thinking about, not even to get into the digital divide and access issues of things about internet access is a whole nother story. So this summer, like I said, we'll be looking at some new things. I'm going to be taking a look at adding, There's a report out called the Horizon Report, and I want to look at some of the trends and things going on. And one of the big things, and it's been ongoing for the last several years, really. But makerspaces are really starting to become popular in the K-12 environment, and I want to learn a little bit more about that. So I might be investigating buying some electronic devices and maybe getting into a little bit of 3D printing or CNC machinery type things. So I want to investigate that a little bit during the summer downtime area, I guess.
Well, and you know, the best way to learn anything is to get to play with it.
Yeah.
And then, so.
And I'm also choosing this topic because I think it's very important to every now and then delve into a subject that you know little or nothing about.
Yeah.
And feel what it's like to be that first time student. And, you know, this is an area I know not very much about, so I'm already on that learning curve. And what I'm finding out is very encouraging because even though like a 3D printer or CN machine can be quite expensive, you can do a lot of design work with free tools. And that's where these makerspaces are coming into play, where you can have like one shared 3D printer and the students can be designing, you know, on a variety of devices and things. So I want to learn a little bit more about that, and it's going to be a little bit of a learning curve for me, but like I said, I'm kind of looking forward to it. My technology pick of the week this week is a report that's been out for a while. It's called the New Media Consortium Horizon Report 2015 version for higher education. They have one of these for higher education and also one for K-12. Mm-hmm. But if you're into ed tech, you're probably familiar with this. This is a report that goes out based on a number of surveys that kind of looks at trends in educational technology. And I'll provide a link in the show notes, but this one's particularly for the 2015 higher education. It's just a PDF file. But one of the nice things about this report is they kind of break things. The name comes for Horizon, looking out on the horizon, seeing what trends are coming to you. But one of the nice things is it breaks things down like, you know, what is current? What's 1 to 2, 3 years out? What's 3 to 5 years out? So looking at some of the different technologies and things.
Have they been pretty accurate with what they've predicted?
The general trends, but I think probably you and I can come up and say, you know, what do you see trending out there? And we just spoke about one, the maker spaces and things, which is, like I said, kind of the maker movement, you know, it's been around probably more than a decade now. But one of the things that makes it trending, besides, you know, being a perfect implementation for science, STEM technology, science, technology, engineering, and math. I mean, it's this hands-on learning, you know, it's all the things that we know that work very well in education. It's not just theory. It's putting things into practice, combining the theory and practice. So, and, you know, there's been various incarnations of the maker movement, you know, all along. Going back, I mean, if you want to go back to whenever we set up our high schools and things, you know, shop schools and things like that. And then, unfortunately, the trades and things seemed to be gutted, particularly in the 1990s.
Yes.
So we lost a lot of our shop classes and things. And this is kind of a resurgence of that in the 21st century. And there's 100 different ways to define what the maker movement is. But there's a nice section on the maker movement in this report, the Horizon Report 2015. But I'll just read 4 or 5 things here. Time to adoption on the horizon, 1 year or less. There's a section talking about BYOD, bring your own device. Flip classroom. Again, you know, the flip videos and things been around for, the, you know, coming on strong for the last 5 years. Time to adoption, 2 to 3 years. They talk about makerspaces.
Very good.
Another reason I think that makerspaces are really becoming popular with the miniaturization, and a lot of this is geared toward electronics and computers and coding.
Mm-hmm.
The price reduction, the processing power. There is a device called the Raspberry Pi, which is like a $25 computer out there, full-function computer that you can build and, you know, plug various components and things in. The other thing mentioned 2 to 3 years out, and we're seeing this a lot, you know, just starting to see this more and more common, wearable technology, embedding technology in clothing, Apple Watch, you know, the iWatch, you know, all these different sensors and things that we have available.
Fitbits,
yeah. And then 4 to 5 years out in the 2015 version, they're listing adaptive learning technologies. Again, we've kind of been through various iterations of that over the years. And then the other big one is that we hear a lot about is, I don't know if you know what the term IoT, have you ever heard that term?
Nope.
Internet of Things. This again is a result of miniaturization of electronics and things, but essentially what's happening is if there's any type of electronic device, they're building in smarts, quote unquote smarts, some artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So your refrigerator will have a chip and have an IP address and can phone into the service company or whatever if it's having trouble. That's just a whole other area. Now, a couple.
So you'd have quality control within individual devices.
Yeah. And, there's a whole other subset of things that lead into these discussions. But, we've heard about big data, mm-hmm. learning analytics, how, and we're undergoing this now. How do we utilize all this data from sensors and things? How do we define the patterns? How do we, how do we use it to improve whatever it is we're trying to improve? The adaptive learning technologies and artificial intelligence. There's things on here that's not even mentioned, like the HoloLens. I think last year's report mentioned augmented reality a little bit more prominently. But with the capability of some of the new technologies to project holograms, back to the old, the vision of, I don't remember, in Star Wars where Princess Leia was projected as a hologram.
Yep.
That technology exists today. And it's just starting to be commercialized to the mass public. And I think in the next couple of years, you're going to see a lot more of that. There's apps like Erasma, for the iPad and things, and Microsoft's doing a lot with HoloLens and Minecraft, kind mm-hmm. of combining, kind of this discussion that we had about, do you need to understand the analog world and the digital world? But this is kind of a step beyond that. This is the digital world with an augmented reality on top of the digital world. It's kind of a weird thing to think about.
Mm-hmm.
But, another potential for these maker spaces and things, designing in three dimensions, you'll be able to develop a character. In fact, I just read an article the other day talking about, you just mentioned the Illinois Literacy mm-hmm. Conference. It would be interesting, let me know whenever you go, but you're starting to see some of that augmented reality onto a book where, you open a book and you see these augmented reality characters pop out of the book, and it's even beginning to get, I've seen some research on doing a reader will speak, and then like the animated character will the lip sync and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So just all kinds of innovations that the digital world's offering us for the first time. And as I said, it's a lot of this is finally becoming affordable for the mass market out there. It's been out there in research labs for a number of years, but when you can take a CNC machine, which used to cost like $100,000, and then drop it down to a $1,000 desktop unit or like a 3D printer. There's many 3D printers under $1,000 now. So we're kind of going through that evolution of what we did like with desktop publishing in the 1980s. Remember?
Right.
Going through that. Suddenly you had a PC and Aldus PageMaker, and you could go out and make your own newspaper, newsletter. That was a big deal back then.
Oh, my gosh, absolutely.
Same thing's happening now with all this computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacturing, these CNC machines, these three-dimensional objects, and you can do for 3D printing. So it's kind of a renaissance in that area. And like I said, what's one of the things I have on my to-do list to learn a little bit more about this summer.
That's it's exciting to look at those things. And again, the cycle of what we're doing and how so many of the things we just are reinventing and improving and all that. And so it's neat. One committee I'm working on with another project, we're talking a lot about collecting data and using it to direct instruction and things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been really, it's something I don't know a lot about and mm-hmm. I'm learning about. And it's like, how do we assess student learning and teacher?
Mm-hmm. And there's privacy concerns with that
right,
as well.
But even like, say if I'm teaching, how can my teaching be evaluated by technology?
Mm-hmm.
You need human hands, you need human eyes, you need human ears
mm-hmm.
to do it. And everything just can't be, even with student assessment, it's hard for me to understand how everything can be done on a computer and everything be assessed on a computer and then...
That makes it worthwhile.
The student, it's the student skills driven. So that data then drives what the next unit is or what the next
That's
step
that
is for
students. Adaptive learning, exactly.
Right. And that. And so, it's awesome. But how do we do that? That's what the teacher has been mm-hmm. charged with doing all these years to individual students and individualized instruction.
Right.
And so how we pull technology into that.
Yeah, there's a section in this report on personalized learning.
Yeah.
I'm doing exactly that.
So I need to read your report, Tom.
There you go. Not my report. It's
the report. New
Media Consortium report. It is very interesting reading, and it's about 50, 60 pages, I think. So it's not too bad, and it's a good quick read. And there's a lot of links and resources, so I'll be sure to put a link in the show notes for that. So that's my tech pick.
All right. Well, mine just comes from literally something I saw on TV this morning. They were talking about the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood and Center for Digital Democracy released a statement saying how, you know, YouTube Kids had inappropriate material on it.
Access to inappropriate.
And that, right. And so it was, you know, basically how these things are getting through to sites that are supposed to be safe for kids. Mm. And so I was thinking about all the teachers and all of the schools who have put out lists of links and resources for students to use, and that you know, either as teachers and as parents and grandparents, we can't just trust all of these sites to have everything
right.
Okay, it's still important for us to be involved, and for as adults to check on what our children. Yeah. Or accessing and looking at.
And it's that age-old debate about filtering and things, you know,
right.
in school. And kind of timely now that we're going into the summer months where we're turning all of our students, you know,
right.
over for the summertime. And they're going to be out there. You know, most schools have some type of filtering system to protect from, you know, some of the inappropriate content. Of course, that is nothing, will not work completely 100%. You still need supervision for that. Definitely same thing, supervision for the parents in the summertime. Again, not that we don't trust, but that there is so much out there that is inappropriate and just a click away.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, completely inadvertent. I'm sure we've all had experiences where we've clicked on a link that's been redirected
right.
to somewhere we didn't necessarily
right.
want to go.
And some of the people that produce this material are very good about using terminology and presenting it in a way that it looks kid-friendly. And then when you get into it.
And both you and I have had conversations as parents and things about how mean we were that we didn't let our kids have computers in the bedroom and things like that. But now today, I mean, you know, with the cell phone use so rampant out there and ubiquitous, that's a computer. They have access to all these websites and things that's available. And my kids are past that age of supervision at this point, but I would be checking some cell phones and, you know, not letting them take them into their bedroom for overnight because, you know, you hear stories every now and then in the news.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'll see studies out there that, you know, students aren't getting enough sleep because
they're
out there FaceTiming their friends or possibly worse.
Because that's why I said at 10 o'clock the phones came in our bedroom to charge overnight because it wasn't so much that just their friends who would be up all night and then send a text or they felt like they needed to answer or needed to respond.
And that goes back to your point earlier. We talked about the need to unplug.
Right.
It's almost addicting, you know, because you're just so overstimulated all of the time that we do need some time to unwind. And, you know, there's a lot more to life than technology. So concentrate on some of those, non-digital.
That's right. Vacation.
Yeah. That wraps it up for episode 177 of Tech Talk for Teachers. Show notes for this episode and archived episodes are available on the web at the EIU Instructional Technology Center website at eiu.edu/ITC. To leave a comment or suggestion, please send an email to techtalk@eiu.edu or leave a comment on the Tech Talk for Teachers blog. Until next time, this is Tom Grissom
and Cindy Rich.
Keep on learning.